What is Montanagonia?
It's a combination of Montana and Patagonia, but it really represents two very wild, special places.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Jim Williams about his nonfiction book, Path of the Puma, The Remarkable Resilience of the Mountain Lion. Together, we'll track pumas across Northwest Montana and South America. Stay with us. And this is a book about mountain lions in Montana and Patagonia, but it isn't necessarily about dire populations. And in fact, you write that mountain lions are the exception to the rule in kind of the cat world. So why write the book?
It's a fascinating species to begin with because people really don't even know they're here for the most part. We never see them. They're very stealthy. And I think that's one of the reasons why they're actually doing okay compared to all the other large cats on planet Earth, which are stable or declining. The mountain lion is reclaiming lost habitats despite us even knowing that they are here.
You come from California and Florida, and you write about your personal history in the book and include photographs of you surfing. And I'm wondering, why was it necessary for you to set the tone and the scene in that way?
Yeah, I really wanted people, you know, where I grew up, to recognize the value of, you know, chasing your dream, getting your education, starting really, we had very little. And my passion at a very young age was biology, whether it was marine biology to start with and wildlife biology now. It inspired me to stick to it and keep on going to school. And I came to Montana in 1988 and I never left. And it's opened up doors that I would have never imagined. But so I wanted to start, you know, on the beach in San Diego, where I put a mask on and looked underneath the water and went, wow, this is an incredible array of species, marine life. And that, you know, I'd been interested in wildlife since I was a child, but that cemented it. And off to college I went.
And how did you decide to leave the ocean sciences and come to the mountains?
Yeah, that's a good story, too. I was in Florida, at Florida State, and this is back kind of pre-internet, and cable TV had just came out, and I watched a show on the Craigheads here in Yellowstone, and that grizzly bear was partially drugged, and I just was amazed, and I thought, wow, you know, I had been working with marine mammals and marine biology jobs, and I thought, wow, I want to do that. And I've always loved the mountains. And I went to the card catalog and you had to go pull them out and look and see some who were the professors in Montana. And I found Dr. Harold Picton. And so I called him up and I said, hey, this is Jim. I want to go to graduate school. And he said, where are you at? And I said, well, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And he said, what do you do? Well, I'm a dolphin trainer. And he said, okay, Mr. Williams, do you know what snows in Montana? And I said, yeah, whatever. And he essentially told me the only chance I had was to show up and start developing relationships and get a program. And that's what I did.
And you've been studying mountain lions for decades in Montana. What do you love about these cats?
I really, you know, mountain lions and people both. My career's been multiple species. Mountain lions have been the common thread, and people too. And my whole career spent delivering conservation at a very local level, which is sometimes messy with people. But cats, whether it's people that care about cats, the cats themselves, the places and the habitats that these cats live, to me are all very special. And to weave them all together throughout a career has been fascinating. And that's, I've been saving these stories for this book. And yeah, it's been kind of a constant theme, whether I've wanted it to be or not, throughout my career.
I want to get into some of the stories and some of the facts about these creatures, but I actually just want to have you read a couple paragraphs from the book.
So part of working with any species, and particularly to learn from them and their movements and where they live, involves capture and handling, which is somewhat invasive, but it's required. You need to learn what the animal does before you can learn how to protect it and the places they live, and that's just part of wildlife science. So this is a description of what I think when I hold these animals in my hands, and particularly when I was younger in my career. And so this is what I'm describing here. It never got old. Every single time I held a captured mountain lion in my hands, I was in awe. Their tawny fur feels short, soft, and thick, but in fact, thin for such a northern mammal. And they struggle to stay warm in sub-zero conditions. It's not uncommon to see ears with signs of frostbite. And they smell, well, like nothing at all. An evolutionary strategy that enables them to both sneak up on prey and to avoid bigger predators. They're athletes, taut with powerful muscle and sinew, unlike the lumbering bears I've come to know over my career. And their paws are massive, the better to wrap around an elk's flank. Push gently on the small black digit pads located above the larger and leathery primary foot pad, and the deadly sharp claw immediately curves up out of the fur. I call those big front paws deer grabbers, and they are built for the grip and kill, meat hooks. But even with all that power, muscle, tooth, and claw, the cats are most vulnerable during the hunt. It's tricky business taking down prey so much larger than themselves, prey that often comes armed with some serious antlers, hooves, and horns. Being a killer is risky. Cats are finely tuned, high-caliber athletes, and making a living means avoiding injury. Some colleagues who are researching deer populations were flying over a herd one day when they spotted a big mule deer buck running hard, with a mountain lion clutched onto its back. The buck slammed to a stop, tossing the lion onto a steep slope, then speared it with a rack of sharp antler. The cat limped away, bleeding, in no shape to stalk and kill and stay alive during the Montana winter.
One fact that I learned is that cats have an innate fear of their rival, Canis lupus, the wolf. Why is that?
So cats and dogs are an issue up here in the Northern Rockies, primarily because wolves are often the top dog, truly the top dog in the woods when it comes to cats. If you think about it, a wolf, it typically hunts with other wolves in a pack, and a young cat can be jumped out of a tree and killed by wolves. But as biologists, scientists, and researchers have surmised or thought about and explored, there are extinct canids that aren't around anymore that probably had an influence as well on cats as they evolved. So a small 30, 40-pound red-bone hound that barks can chase a 150-pound male cat up a tree. So there's this innate fear of a barking canid. And I tend to think, I tend to agree with everything else that I've read, that not only wolves, but perhaps some canids that are extinct that were around the Ice Age that were here that were dangerous to cats, mountain lions in particular.
I love this relationship between predator and prey and how humans fall into it. And I want to circle back around to that point. But in thinking about the wolf, it got me wondering about what your sense of the mountain lion or cats are in the American psyche. What do they represent, or how, I mean, because they're so unseen and yet so feared.
Mm-hmm. Well, mountain lions are, you know, the cougar, puma, mountain lion, they're all the same.
Right.
Panther. They play a pretty important role in native cultures as well as current society, in that, you know, some people may never see them.
Yeah.
But they want to know they're there. That the mountain lions represent a healthy operating natural system. And I've heard that over and over again throughout my career. And most folks will never see one in the wild. They're very cryptic. They're very stealthy. They're active at dawn and dusk and at night. And they're just like your house cat. They're not going to run through the open field. They're going to go to a bush, to the edge, and kind of stalk around. But people want to know they're there.
Right. And I was thinking about my own relationship to mountain lions. And in the book, you make a point, rarely do they present a threat to humans. And yet, I think a lot of people are frightened if they catch a glimpse or see a track or scat.
Yes, I liken it to, you know, when I was a child surfing and a shark. You know, the actual attacks are, you know, we're all at more risk walking and driving, and especially right here in Montana on winter roads. But we're kind of hardwired for large carnivores way back in the recesses of our monkey brains to be afraid of bears and lions and sharks and stuff like that. And it makes the news. And yeah, it's our imaginations really conjure some wild fears up. But in reality, the odds of having a conflict are very, very, very small. And we're more at risk, you know, from a host of other threats.
And thinking about this word conflict, you write about your time in Augusta, Montana, which is a small town on the Front Range, and you had several encounters with locals and ranchers. And I'm just wondering, when you reflect back on that time, navigating the line between humans and mountain lions, has anything changed in terms of the tensions?
Yes and no. I think, you know, Augusta is the real deal.
Yeah.
It's like going back in time. It's a special place, special people. I'm still friends with folks there from 30 years ago, and it's a wild place. But the tension and the conflict, whether it's in South America or up here in the American West, between livestock and then large carnivores that can kill livestock, like a bear or a lion or a wolf or a coyote, is there today. And it's an issue. They're trying to make a living. You know, they're trying to stay in business, and it's not easy. And carnivores are an issue. At the same time, you know, as a graduate student, when you jump into that world, all excited about an animal and a place, and you get a dose of reality really quick of where you are, and as a newcomer, and as a research, as a graduate student, and boy, that was. You know, I'd argue that was equally as important as the academic part of my graduate experience.
Absolutely. And my favorite line from the book comes from your time in Augusta, where you interviewed some local kids at the school after a mountain lion had been found on the playground. And you write that one girl had said to you, "It's real friendly. It follows you and looks at you friendly-like in the bushes as you walk by." Do you remember what you were thinking when you heard that?
Yeah, that was actually terrifying, knowing that they're a stock ambush predator. And typically when a bear or a lion becomes habituated, they lose that innate fear of people. They are a risk. And, you know, it's regrettable, but, you know, they're removed from the population. And, well, when you have that at a schoolyard, well, that kicked everything into high gear. And I ultimately, you know, killed that cat and removed it. Yeah. But you have to understand that it's always regrettable to remove an animal, but you know, as scientists, we look at populations and healthy habitats, not the individual. So, yeah, it's regrettable, but to maintain tolerance from today's society, from small rural communities in the West or even down in Patagonia, you have to you know, work with people to stay safe. Mm-hmm. Or as humans, we won't tolerate them, and we can eliminate them very easily.
Right. What's one myth you'd like to dispel about mountain lions?
Oh, I think there's been some really, really neat advances in technology using genetic and population monitoring. And the density of cats typically is about 2 to 4 adults per 100 square kilometers. But when you use some of these new techniques, it can jump up even higher because you get the transients that haven't settled. But even then, you know, you can hit 6. Even then, which there is a ceiling, a threshold, they just don't keep increasing forever, which I hear that all the time. They can kill each other, and they do. They're somewhat territorial. We're still learning technology, and now with video cameras and remote cameras, we're learning about behaviors. There are biologists. They're learning some amazing things. But they're not going to increase forever. There is a ceiling, and typically they're at that natural density or less, depending upon if they're hunted, if they're removed for livestock, or what have you. But they're behaviorally limited to some degree.
Hmm. So they're not just going to breed and take over Western Montana?
No. Now, people maybe, yes.
I was going to say.
See, just take a look at the Gallatin Valley, Missoula, and Kalispell. People are doing a good job of that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Jim Williams about his book, Path of the Puma, The Remarkable Resilience of the Mountain Lion. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at ntpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You talk about wildness in a way that I've not read before, and I feel like I've read a lot of books on nature and wilderness. You talk about a felt sense of wildness to where we stand in the food chain, that places you go where you might feel most wild energy is where you are lowest, you know, where there might be 4 or 5 creatures above you. Do you think that there's an inherent sense to being put in our place as a species related to feeling the wild?
Yes, and I think we've evolved that way for thousands of years. And here we are with all the conveniences of modern society today, and they're luxuries. They keep us alive. We live longer. But I truly think as humans, we need these places to step into away from all the technology and help that we have and experience that feeling of wild country, truly wild country. And Montana still has that. Montana's unique. It's unique in the West. It's unique in the world, really. It's a special place.
Can you tell me a specific location that does that for you? That
Oh, the North Fork of the Flathead is off the charts, wild. The Bob Marshall, the Rocky Mountain Front, all these small roadless pockets, and even some places in and around developed cities that have little pockets of wild left. But the North Fork and the Bob and the Rocky Mountain Front in Montana and Glacier Park all have all the species still here today that were here, you know, 1,000 years ago. And the interactions and the opportunity to encounter one are there. And people do.
And for our listeners outside of Montana, can you just describe the North Fork and the Bob?
So the North Fork of the Flathead is the western side of Glacier National Park. And it's a wild river that originates in British Columbia. But there's one road up to a little town called Polebridge, which has this wonderful baked goods at the Merck. And it part, I think they taste so good because it's so remote up there. But there are wolves, grizzly bears, black bears, mountain lions, lynx, bobcat, wolverine, all the ungulates. Everything is there. And everything still plays out naturally on the landscape. In fact, it was probably 20 years ago, a graduate student from this university here at University of Montana was looking at coyotes and wolves, and a grizzly bear did not even den. It spent the winter out usurping lion and wolf kills. So can you imagine cross-country skiing and seeing a bear out in January? I mean, that's typically not normal, but it's a wild place. It's kind of a large predator party up there that still operates in a natural system today.
I love this term, predator party. I don't know that I would want to be a party goer. You include a bit by science writer David Quammen, in which he makes note that early hominids were prey. And to couch it, you write, humans will never get over the fact that at one point in our history, we were a source of meat.
Yes. And again, we're, especially in first world developed countries, we're kind of removed from that. But, you know, think about Africa and walking into the bush there. You're pretty low on the food chain. And the opportunity to still, as a human, be meat for some native carnivore is there. And here less so, but it's possible. We tend not to think of ourselves as prey, but at one time we were. And of course, civilizations were created, humans evolved, and all sorts of means of protection, whether it's through intellect or behaviors in groups, you know, we're removed from that in today's world, in most societies.
Is there value in that experience?
That's a loaded question. I'm not sure. I think it depends on your perspective. I kind of enjoy the safeties, you know, the how safe we are and the lives we lead today. But then on the other hand, I feel most alive in the woods knowing that all these species are still there. All of your senses are firing at once. It really heightens the experience. And I think that's one of the things that sets Montana apart from many other states in this country is that we still, you know, can experience those feelings.
After talking about humans in the food chain, you wrote another line and you said, there's nothing better than exploring places no one's been before. And when I read that, Jim, part of me was like, yeah, absolutely. And then another part of me was like, is that a privileged statement? And is this sort of this frontier mentality? And is it even okay to say that anymore? And I just sort of wanted to grapple with that with you. Like, do you have a sense of what's ours for the taking or claiming and who gets to do it? And
yeah, well, it's all relative, right? So I think it's a personal feeling because when you're hiking in wild country, particularly here in Montana, you know, it truly does feel to you personally like no one has been here before, but clearly there are First Nations and cultures that have been here for thousands of years.
Exactly.
But that feeling of discovery, that feeling of the first time you've been in this wild place, and that perhaps, you know, it's been 1,000 years since someone was in a basin or a drainage or on a trail or behind a rock near a tree, that's a special thing, you know, and that's a personal connection to nature. And so, yeah, well, while clearly people have been here for thousands of years, native cultures, but that feeling of being the first one in there, you can still enjoy today. So yeah, it is privileged somewhat, but on the other hand, it's a personal connection to nature that I think is exciting that everyone can experience.
Yeah. And I think the word that that resonates is discovery, right? Just that sense of...
Yes.
One of the lines you write is, "I've always dreamed in landscapes." What did you mean when you wrote that?
I'm a very visual person. Since I was a child, I could memorize mountain ranges on checks and calendars, and I knew where they were. I've always enjoyed landscapes. In fact, landscapes have defined my entire career, marine biology, wildlife biology, where I've lived, what I've done. Landscapes are important to me. I particularly like dramatic landscapes. Mm-hmm. I've been fortunate enough to visit lots of incredible landscapes in my life, and I'll never take that for granted. I was able to raise my kids and my family in these landscapes as well.
Will you compare and contrast South America, its landscape, to Northwest Montana?
So South American pumas, particularly Patagonia pumas, live in a very similar environment to Montana mountain lions. They call them pumas down there. We call them mountain lions here. They're the same thing for the most part. The mountains in Patagonia, believe it or not, are larger and more vast than the mountains in Montana. So you take the crown of the continent, Glacier Park and the Bob Marshall, and then you just kind of double the scale and the size and the breadth and the wow factor. That's what you get in Patagonia. Interestingly, the densities of people are relatively similar. They're both lightly populated. They both have some agricultural components to the landscape still today. But they both, the Andes and the Rockies, are pretty similar in terms of issues people deal with. Now, the wildlife species assemblages are totally different down there versus up here.
That was a part I really enjoyed about the book, is learning these other creatures. Did you have a favorite one that you encountered down south?
Yes. I really love guanacos. So keep in mind, in Patagonia, it's all cats and camels.
Okay.
Up here, it's deer and elk and mountain lions. Down there, it's cats and camels. And they have two. They have a vicuña, and that's more northern Chile and Argentina. And it looks similar to an alpaca, like a wild version. And a guanaco looks like a wild llama. These guanacos are in herds, and they have a very long neck. I mean, pumas and guanacos, that's the native prey for pumas. But they're very vocal, very whimsical, they're very social. I could watch guanacos all day long. They're very entertaining. They make some really interesting and entertaining noises, and they communicate. There's just a lot of fun. But that's where there are guanacos, there are pumas.
Right. How are the puma populations doing down there?
It's variable in Patagonia. And in Argentina, where the larger ranches are, the sheep ranches, pumas are still pretty much persecuted to this day. Where they are tolerated, they're doing fine. And they're actually reclaiming former habitats in Patagonia as well. On the Chilean side, it's a deeper forest, a little more ice and rock, and kind of looks like the North Cascades or glacier. There are fewer people. But where there are ranches, there are conflicts, and it's primarily domestic sheep. And you have generations of gauchos. They're like our cowboy culture. But the gauchos have been trained for generation after generation to take all pumas out because they kill domestic sheep. And so it's a different system of protected areas and conservation down there than we enjoy up here.
I want to dial back in time to the 1967 Disney film, Charlie the Lonesome Cougar. I was so delighted to see you write about that, because that and the Yellowstone Cubs were two of my favorites growing up. And I went and watched a YouTube clip of Charlie, this mountain lion, riding a log down a flume. And I just thought, how bizarre. And I wanted to check in with you now. You know, how does that look in the rear view? And what do you think that kind of depiction of a well-trained cat, you know, with this funny narration, what does it do for us?
Yeah, it's totally Disneyfied. But, you know, children today, and I really believe this, need to be inspired and need to connect with the outdoors and with wildlife. And if that's what it takes is a fun story to get someone off a phone or off the computer and be inspired by an animal, whether it's a lion, a bear, a deer, an elk, hey, so be it. That was one of the first movies I ever saw as a child, and I never forgot it. I still enjoy it today. It's hokey. It's narrated by Rex Allen. It's just a classic Disney movie, but it takes place in the mountains, and it's a wild species. And, you know, whether it's Charlie the Lonesome Cougar or any type of old show like that, if it inspires someone to learn more or to go outside and find them, that's a good thing in today's society, I think.
The book offers lots of information, including maps with habitat information, conservation ideas, and how to handle a mountain lion encounter. So my last question is in regards to the tip that you offer, which is let the puma know you're not a deer. What does that look like on the ground?
Yeah, so we get calls every week, you know, at Fish, Wildlife, and Parks asking, you know, what do I do? There's a lion track. You know, when the snows come, they can, you know, typically people see the tracks and whether they're, you know, adults or children. And we always advise people to, with a cat, to let them know you're not a deer, essentially, by raising your hands, yelling, making noise. They are pretty hardwired for deer-sized prey or camel-sized prey in Patagonia, you know, guanacos, vicuñas. But their search image, you know, 99% of the time works. But every now and again, you get a young cat that isn't quite, you know, hasn't fine-tuned their hunting skills. And they're going to look at a person, you know, are you food or not? And so we always advise people to, you know, clap your hands, yell, take your jacket off, throw stuff at it, kick rocks at it. And particularly if you see the cat first. And rarely do we have actual encounters and conflicts, very rarely. But it does happen, and of course it's tragic when it does. But yeah, let them know you're not a deer.
Though he grew up in the sun and sand of California, Jim Williams lives in northwest Montana, where he's a wildlife biologist and supervisor for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin's studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.